Hey, After Buzzers, before we move on to your next topic, we just want to say thanks to our sponsor, Anchor. If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. It's free. Plus, there are creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Also, Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. Plus, you can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership, and it's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to Anchor FM to get started. My on-screen relationship with Brent Jennings began in 2011 with Moneyball, but the man has been working in TV and film since the 80s in a very long and beautiful career. Guys, I am very excited to talk with Brent Jennings. We've got the full interview right after this.
You're tuned in to AfterBuzz TV, the ESPN of TV talk. Now, let the buzz begin.
Ah, yes. The theme to Lodge 49, which is, of course, the show that you're starring in right now as a series regular. Guys, we are here with Spotlight On. I'm so excited to be talking with Brent Jennings. Brent, thank you for being here.
Thank you for asking me to be here.
Of course. I'm really excited. You're the kind of actor I love talking to just because you've had such a long and very prolific career on so many shows I love. Uh-huh. So I feel like it gives me a behind-the-scenes look into, you know, just this business. It's going to be really exciting.
Right.
Before we dive in, though, guys, my name is Jeff Graham. This is Spotlight On, where we interview some of Hollywood's hottest up-and-comers or veterans, either behind the camera or in front of the camera. And I'm so excited to have Brent here. You guys have seen Brent in a lot. You've seen him in shows all the way from Hill Street Blues to Shameless to The Newsroom. I mean, I pulled up your IMDb, and there are 100 credits. And it's pretty cool that your 100th credit on your IMDb is Lodge 49.
Yeah, you know, that was my goal at one time, to get 100 credits.
You know,
it's just, maybe it's, that was just, I don't know, just something that popped into my head one day. I want to have 100 credits at least.
Well, if you keep going at this rate, you'll have 200 before you're done in this business.
I mean,
even shows Modern Family, Murder in the First, Suburgatory, The Crazy Ones. I mean, we will not finish this interview if I read your IMDb. So part of what I'm excited about is just to figure out how to tackle such an amazingly long career. But I want to start by talking about Lodge 49, because that's, of course, what you're here promoting right now.
Mm-hmm.
I love this show.
Great.
It's very strange and very wonderful and just has these really rich characters. And it's funny, I love the pilot, but I don't think you really start to understand the show until you start to see more episodes.
Right, exactly.
And things come back. And I'm wondering, for you, how do you describe the show when people ask you about Lodge 49?
You know, that's really such a involved question. You know, it's sort of a modern day fable.
Mm.
It's described as such. It's sardonic. It has wit. It has moments of just pure farce and humor. And then it has these real moments of real pathos and human emotion and connection, because it's dealing with a lot of things, like underlying the show, the themes of grief and loss, and how do you find your way after suffering, you know, an extreme loss, and your life sort of goes into the new direction you're not expected, as we see in Dud. You know, he's at the top of the show. When we meet him, he's in total disarray. You know, his father has mysteriously died. They've lost their business, their home. So he and his sister are left with this enormous debt, you know, and he's sort of just trying to find a place to fit in and belong and start over again. And he finds this sort of lodge with all of these sort of eclectic, you know, crazy characters, mm-hmm. who also are lost in their own various ways for various reasons. So it's about people coming together, connecting with each other,
yeah.
going on these little adventures where they're trying to achieve some sort of silly goal in some ways, you know. Mm. And so it's fun. It has hope in it. It has a belief in, you know, humanity and people striving and getting up and resilience. It's all those things. I don't know if that is a succinct answer or if it makes any sense, but it's just about people trying to live their lives and overcome all of these things that we all find in our lives that are challenging us, you know, sudden unemployment, sudden loss, you know.
Generational conflict.
Generational conflict, looking for love, looking for, as in Ernie's case, something, a reason to feel that his life has been worthwhile mm. by achieving a business opportunity that will sort of put him on the map. He's a man who lives alone, And so he's trying to find companionship through pursuing this long-lost high school sweetheart. And he's at the point in his life where the window is closing, and he's just trying to fit in there with something to keep it open a little bit and feel like, you know, my life is worth something. I want to be the supreme leader, the sovereign protector of the lodge, which is the ultimate position of leadership in the local lodge. So, you know, he has all these aspirations and desires to make his life worthwhile, as all of them do, the characters in one way or another. And so it's about that, aspiring and striving and getting up when you fall back down.
Yeah, I love the way you're describing it. Makes the show sound like a really beautifully, richly written novel. And of course, the show creator, Jim Gavin, was a novelist before he came to TV. So what was that like, entering a set where the showrunner and creator was a novelist first?
Well, the thing about it was when I first read the pilot script, one of the things that just intrigued me about it was how well written it was and how well defined the characters are and the subtleties and nuances of the script. And the humor is not the kind of in-your-face humor. It's very literary. It reads like a short story or a novel with that kind of detail. Having Jim around and knowing what the tone of it is really supposed to be and how it works best was, of course, great, because he was always there to make sure that we actors, you know, hit it in the right way, you know, played it in a way that sort of was true to the material and its intent as far as tone goes, you know. So it's just great material. It's the kind of material you read and you go, man, I can't believe, you know, that I may have an opportunity to play this part in this show with this kind of writing. And you've been watching the show and you can see the writing. It sustains itself. I mean, it grows. It doesn't get worse. It gets better.
Right.
And that's unusual, you know. So it's just a real joy to be in something that has a sort of iconoclastic point of view, you know. It's just sort of, it doesn't see things in a way that other shows see things, you know. It stands on its own as a very individual, unique point of view on life. And it's written with in a very unique way about just real people, real everyday people. So it was a breath of fresh air.
Absolutely. For those listening, you've heard all of our wonderful praise of Lodge 49. It's airing on AMC. You can catch it after Better Call Saul. And I believe you can watch the whole season online right now and binge it, which
Monday,
I need to go
Monday
do.
Monday nights. Monday nights.
And it's on Monday nights. That's right. Yeah. Monday nights on AMC. I love that you mentioned how iconoclastic and unique it is, because I think AMC is doing such a good job of pushing that kind of content. And I think it really beautifully fits in that slot right after Better Call Saul, because that's also a very iconoclastic
show.
So.
Exactly.
I want to come back to Lodge 49 because I want to talk about Ernie and just whether, like, how you're relating to him and if you're relating to him. I also have so much other stuff I want to talk about.
Okay.
So for you Lodge 49 fans, we'll come back. For those of you who haven't seen the show, check it out. It's very, very good. Let's dive back, though, because I love hearing about how actors start. You're from Arkansas. Did you grow up in a very theatrical family, or was this something you kind of discovered on your own?
Not at all. I was the nut in the neighborhood who was walking around saying he was going to be an actor, and I'd go over to my friend's house. I remember one evening I had a friend named Tony Dotson, and he lived two blocks away. I used to, you know, go by his house, and his mother would go, "Tony, here comes the actor, you know." And she would tease me, "So you're going to do commercials?" "So no, I'm not doing any commercials. Are you kidding? I'm an actor. I'm going to be an actor." But it started for me there in Little Rock, Arkansas. I was in the sixth grade, and I did a school play. And the teacher who directed the play, it just goes to show you how someone can come along and just drop a little idea in your head, and it changes your life.
Yeah.
And she said to me, "You should think about becoming an actor. And you have a good speaking voice. You have a good sense of timing." And I was like, wow, you know. And during the play, we would rehearse in the school cafeteria. You know, they had shifts for lunches. You know, like the first through third graders would eat while we were rehearsing on stage, and then by the time it was time for the fourth and fifth and sixth grade kids to come in and eat, then we were done, you know. So these little kids started following me around the playground, you know. And so I sort of sensed that I had something that people liked. Mm. And when you're that young and you have an impact on people like that, you start to say, well, maybe I am good at this. Maybe this is something I should do. So I started researching it.
Wow.
And there was this place where you could go on Tuesdays and you could get the papers from around the country. And I would get the New York Times and I would read the arts and leisure section. And I'd read about all this stuff going on in New York City. So I would say to myself, well, I got to get to New York City. You know, I got to get out of here. And that became my sort of growing up, my ambition. And I just started researching that and working towards that and ended up going to college in Boston. Had a nice career there and then moved to New York. Had a nice career there and came to L.A. So that's the short version. Yeah.
So that's so interesting. I mean, I would think coming from Little Rock,
mm-hmm.
I just would have to imagine you mentioned it, but people probably discouraged you to pursue such a...
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Because particularly at the time when I was interested in it, there weren't like a lot of African-American actors that you could look at and go, yeah, he can do that. I mean, there was Sidney Poitier and a few other guys, you know, and I didn't look anything like Sidney Poitier. I'm just a regular looking guy, you know, and they would go like, you know, don't you have to be like, look like a model to do that? You know, and you know, where are you going to fit in that? You know, everyone thought I was really my best friend's mother. I remember she once said to me, Brent, you know, that's I don't think you should be thinking like this, you know. And even my mother would say, Brent, you know, you can't control your own destiny in that.
Mm.
You know, you're wasting your intelligence. You know, why don't you be a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, something where you can actually use your mind and, you know, have some influence on what happens. You know, she just thought it was a random kind of thing, you know, whether you were successful or not. And I understood that because people weren't used to people around them pursuing careers in the arts, you know. And but I persevered, and my dad was really a big supporter. And he felt like, you know, he used to say, well, you know, the man who takes a chance is the man who gets ahead, you know. So I went ahead and pursued it. And as I started to accomplish things, my first Broadway show or something like that, then the thaw broke, you know, and it was all, you know, support, and,
right.
you know, and every time
once
I
you start
home,
doing okay, that's
yeah,
when people
yeah,
we
yeah.
knew the whole time
yeah,
you
yeah.
were going to make it.
Yeah, and every time you do something, the local paper prints it up,
yeah.
and you come home, and you know your high school friends or whatever throw a party because they want you to be there. They, you know, I ended up getting a lot of encouragement from my hometown as I moved through the business.
Cool. That's nice to hear.
You know,
I do want to ask you, because you said you started in New York.
Uh-huh.
When you were first envisioning acting as a career, rather mm-hmm. than just a hobby or a passion,
mm-hmm.
did you picture TV film? Did you picture stage? Where did you see yourself?
Well, at the time that I started, theater was sort of like the predominant
mm-hmm.
avenue. You know, that's where the real opportunities were for roles you could sort of bite into and really grow as an actor. And I started out professionally in Boston with a company called Theater Company of Boston. And when I was 19, 20 years old, I got my equity card and was doing plays with guys coming up from New York. Al Pacino, for instance, we did The Basic Training of Pablo Hummel, which eventually went to Broadway, and other stuff. And so I was sort of working while I was actually in college. So when I got to New York, my goal was, I said to myself, well, I want to do just 5 years of theater. I'm not interested in TV or film for the first 5 years. And that's kind of what I did, you know. And it's funny because almost to the day that 5 years was up, I got my first film. And it happened to be a story that took place in Arkansas.
Wow.
And it was about a prison farm that where guys were mysteriously disappearing. And you find out that they've been killed by the guards and all of this. It was a big scandal. There was a graveyard out somewhere with all these bodies in it. And I had heard about the case growing up.
Wow.
So I was doing a Broadway play called G.R. Point. It was closing. An actor friend of mine came by and said, hey, they're casting for this movie. It's set in Arkansas. He didn't even know I was from Arkansas. What's it about? Oh. So I went over to the casting director's office and I took a picture and resume. And I wrote out, hey, my name is Brent Jennings. I'm from Arkansas. I know the whole story. You need to talk to me.
Smart.
And she called me, and I went in, and that's how I got my first film.
Was that shot on location? Or
no, it was actually shot in Ohio, Lima, Ohio.
Oh, outside yeah.
of Robert Redford, Jane Alexander, a film called Brubaker. And I was, you know, in my 20s and got the film and even negotiated. I didn't even have an agent because at that time in New York, as far as theater goes, you built up your own reputation. You can hustle your own work. And so I had to negotiate my salary. And it was supposed to be a two-week job. And she was going to pay me $800, I think it was. And I said, no, you got to give me $1,000.
There you go. Hard line.
Yeah, she's like, what are you talking about? You never done a film before. I said, yeah, but I just came out of a Broadway play. You got to give me $1,000. And she did. And then they end up finding a director and bringing out a new director. And the movie, he decided to keep me around for the duration of the shoot. So I ended up with 10 weeks of work instead of 2 weeks of work, with $10,000 instead of $2,000. And it turned out to be a great experience. Yeah.
So at that point, was Robert Redford Robert Redford?
He was Robert Redford.
So what was that like as a newer TV film actor to go on a set with Robert Redford?
Well, it was... It wasn't frightening, you know. He was a very, you know, generous guy. You know, he wasn't in any way, I'm Robert Redford, you know. He was just doing his job. It felt really good to be there, you know, because little milestones like that make you feel like, okay, well, I'm here, right. you know. And I felt good about being there. And he was just, I had a few scenes with him, and he was cool, you know? I mean, it really wasn't anything that I remember as being something that overwhelmed me,
right.
or in any way intimidated me. And, you know, my dad used to also say, when you get where you're trying to go, you're going to realize you've been there all the time.
Mm.
It was that kind of a thing.
Right.
You know?
And at a certain point, I mean, professional actors, you're doing your job.
You're doing your job, yeah. You know.
You're on set. You know, everyone's
right.
servicing the story.
Right. Everyone's servicing the story.
Yeah.
And you're doing your job. And, you know, there's no reason to, you know, be a fan. You know, you just be an actor. So.
Right. So I want to talk about your TV career.
But there was one good thing about that show.
Oh, I want to hear.
Show.
What was that?
You talk about the old days and how things were different.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, it was a really, really festive kind of set. Because after we would shoot all day, we'd go back to the hotel and there'd be a table of goodies, you know, snacks and stuff. And we would sit down and watch the dailies.
Oh, cool.
So I got to learn a lot about film acting. By talking to people like Redford, Jane Alexander, the more experienced actors who were there, Yaphet Kotto, and looking at the dailies and seeing what was working on film and how do you approach film as opposed to stage. So it was a really good learning experience. So.
It's so true because now people who are specifically pursuing a career in TV film, they'll take classes where they can actually shoot themselves and look at what they're doing.
Right.
I know I'm not an actor at all,
right.
but I know that it demands a very specific set of muscles versus stage acting.
Right, right.
But you probably had never had the chance to see yourself on screen before.
No, I never had. Never had. It was the first thing that I ever did, you know, and to be able to watch not only my work, because my part was very much a supporting part, a very small part, even though, you know, I'm popping up through the movie. But to watch his technique and see, oh, on stage, you know, it comes from here, you know, in the voice. But in film, it comes from here, your eyes and your thoughts read. So, you know, so if you're thinking as the character, you don't have to use words, you know. So you see all these things and you start to go, okay, this is a different medium than the stage. And, you know, you start to develop a way to approach it, which started on that film. So it was a big learning experience for me.
Well, speaking of your early career, you've made appearances on so many big shows in the 80s, especially cop shows. I mean, we have Cagney and Lacey, Hill Street Blues, Miami Vice, 21 Jump Street. What's so interesting to me about this, and something I've never seen on TV nowadays, is you made three separate appearances on Miami Vice, but as three separate characters.
Well, two separate characters.
Okay. So can you, this is something, I mean, I feel like we don't see this in TV anymore.
Yeah, it's funny that that came up, because I was talking about that just a few days ago. Miami Vice came up, and we were talking about Edward James Olmos' performance in it. Mm-hmm. And I did the very first show of the first season, not the pilot, but the first show. And that was Eddie's first show, because he replaced the guy, the pilot.
Oh, wow.
And I was watching his, off camera, watching his approach to the role. You know, if you remember, I don't know if you remember Miami Vice, but he was a very stoic kind of guy who didn't move much, didn't say much, you know, was just very composed. And I'm watching him and this choice, and I'm going, man, that's really, wow, look at what this guy is doing. Hmm. And I remember going up to him to show you how crazy I was. I say, hey, you think this is going to work? You think you can hold this? You know, you think you can play this, like, all the way through? I'm talking about episode after episode, you know. And he goes, yeah. I said, okay, well, great, you know. You know. And I would see him later. It was always warm, you know, whenever I saw him, the few times I saw him. He remembered that. And maybe by that time he had seen more of me as well. But I was just really, once again, you're looking at a film performance, a performance on film, and seeing how bold that was, and how, in my view at that time, risky, but seeing like, well, on film, if you're convicted enough and you believe in it, you can make something like that work. And it was a great character.
Absolutely.
You know? No one else would ever approach that role like that.
So was that common? I'm just looking at your credits.
I don't think so. Because I did the first episode of the first season. Then I came back in the middle. Now, you're right. They were three different characters. I came back in the middle and did another character. Then I did the last episode of the last season.
It's pretty cool. You bookended the show.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Nobody knows that but us.
There you go. Now all of our listeners, right?
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, I mean, with just such an extensive filmography, I wish we had 3 hours. But I want to ask you, when you look back on your career, do you feel like there was a moment that you look at as your break? Or do you feel like it's always just been this slowly growing snowball of work?
I think it's sort of been like a continuum, you know? I've had my lulls. And I've had times when things are just popping, you know, and I'm going from project to project. And, you know, I've always been a character actor as opposed to that romantic lead or that, you know, lead guy. So, you know, it always seems to come in sort of phases. I remember once I was in a restaurant. I was having, I think, breakfast, and this producer came over to me and he says, I don't know why I keep doing this. I feel like something, but I'm okay, right? Okay. This producer came over to me and he says, hey, how you doing? I goes, Fine. He says, hey, I want you to know, I really like your work, you know. And he says, you know, I've seen you like over like, he said, 4 decades. And he says, I'm like, in every decade, you come up, you turn up in something special. I go, okay. And he goes, it's a real tribute to longevity. And I just said, thanks, you know. But that's the way it's been, you know. It's been sort of like just, there have been times when I wanted to like bail out and go like, well, I don't know if I've hit a wall. One time I went without work and I had my kids in private school and I wanted to keep them there. And I went and I started substitute teaching, you know, and a job came up for assistant drama instructor and drama instructor and assistant admissions director. And they offered it to me. They knew that things were tight, you know. This was about a 2 or 3 year period where things were just really slow. And so I said, well, I think I'm going to interview this for the free tuition. You know, my kids would be solid and all of that. So I go in and I say, we have the interview. And at the end of the interview, I says, well, okay, how much will this pay? And she told me the figure. And I started to kind of laugh. And I said, you want me to come in here every day for that? You know, and I'm thinking, that's why I'm here now, you know. And I thought to myself, well, I don't want to put that kind of cap on my earning potential.
Right. They weren't SAG rates, you're saying.
No.
Okay.
No. So it was really funny. I kind of broke through that period. And I would think back to, like, wow, I was doing Life and then A Lesson Before Dying. I did those kind of back-to-back. And I had great fun on both those shows with the parts and the other actors and really good material. And I would think to myself, man, if I had gotten scared, I wouldn't be here enjoying this now.
Wow.
You know? So it's been like that, you know? Mm.
I mean, looking at your credits, I may be wrong in saying this because you've had arcs on plenty of shows, mm-hmm. but is this your first series regular role?
I did a series regular on a show called The Antagonist okay. on CBS that ran for like 13 weeks in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. Lauren Holly, David Andrews, myself, you know, a few other people I can't recall. I bought my house on that show because it was one of those things where I said, this show is not going to really go.
Sometimes with the network.
Yeah, you know. Just kind of sense it. Right. And you go, well, let me save all my money and go in and talk to these mortgage brokers while everything looks great. You know, and that's how we got our house. You know,
wow.
My wife is also an actress. And so that's how we got our house. And mm-hmm. then after that, all hell broke loose. It's like,
yeah.
that we're trying to keep it, you know, you know, but we're still in it. So.
Well, and that's what's so cool is to think that, speaking of longevity and persistence, now you're on this acclaimed show as
right.
a series regular. And
right.
I just think that speaks so much to the importance of just this business is not a smooth one.
Yeah.
No matter who
right.
you are,
right.
you look
right.
at, you talk to the most famous A-listers and they yeah. talk about dry seasons.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Ben Affleck, it's a different experience, but mm-hmm. he'll talk about the early 2000s booking mm-hmm. stinker after stinker.
Right, and right.
I just think that's so... It's so valuable for aspiring actors to hear this.
Yeah,
from...
yeah. And I think for me, you know, it's like I really do love what I do. And I tell younger actors, I've taught over at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts as an adjunct, go in and direct plays, and they'll ask questions. And I'll say, look, if you can find something else that you love to do and satisfies you, go do that.
Mm.
But don't do this.
Right.
You know, but if nothing else can fill that for you, you know, this business kind of chooses you, you know, is the way I feel about it.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then you just have to be true to that and everything works out.
Right.
In the end.
Because who would voluntarily sign up for this?
For rejection, rejection, yeah. rejection, rejection, you know.
Yeah, it's really wise.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I do feel like I have to talk about Moneyball because mm-hmm. I love this movie. Mm-hmm. And Aaron Sorkin is one of my favorite writers. You worked with Sorkin twice because
yeah.
you initially worked with him on Moneyball. Then
right.
he brought you back to
right.
work on The Newsroom, which that's got to be one of those check marks as an actor where
yeah.
you're just like, Aaron Sorkin wants me.
Right, right.
That's pretty cool. But
yeah.
Can you just talk a little bit about Moneyball? Obviously, working with Brad so closely, mm-hmm. Chris Pratt, Robin
mm-hmm.
Wright. I mean,
mm-hmm.
like, it's this amazing cast. What was that experience like?
Well, Bennett Miller was a great director to work with. He's a very... he knows how to create a process that this demands a lot of you, but at the same time, it's a very comfortable way to work,
mm.
if you know what I mean. You know, he's not boisterous or invasive or, manipulative. You know, he really understands the process and how to communicate to get the most out of you. We did a scene with Brad, and I went to Chris's house to persuade him to play first base, was it?
That's right.
First base for the A's.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked on that scene from about 12 o'clock till we wrapped that day at 7:30. And some of it, of course, was cut out and all of that went in the final version. But I remember at one point, I forgot I was acting.
Wow.
I remember noticing that, you know, at one point it just got so fluid, you know, from being so committed to it for the amount of time and the amount of focus that we had. It just became something that flowed. And he created that. And what I like about that film is that every scene in the movie is complete, you know, and precise and just as good as the scene before and the scene after. You can't, if you look at that movie, it doesn't fall down anywhere. Every scene is meticulously crafted, you know. So it was just a pleasure to be involved in that kind of a process, you know.
Sure.
And, of course, being a fan of Brad Pitt's and knowing of him for a long time, he was very easy to work with. He's kind of like what you see is what you get with him. Mm. You know, I mean, his persona on screen is just kind of, you know, well-adjusted, you know.
Calm, cool,
collected. Calm, cool, affable guy, you know. And without pretenses and, you know, so he was very much like that.
Cool.
So it was good.
That's, yeah, I like hearing that because I like Miller's work a lot. I love Capote and Foxcatcher was so good too. And you can tell he's a serious director,
right.
But one, I'm glad to know that he values the actor.
Right.
He's able to set high expectations for you
without,
again, yeah, belittling the process of what actors bring to a film.
There's some guys who make movies and some guys who make films. He's a filmmaker.
Yeah, I love that. That's very well said. So I want to talk, I want to go back to Lodge 49 because I'm loving this show. Again, I wish we had more time, but that's okay. So you were talking about Ernie.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about how on the show you mentioned that he's worried that there's a chapter of his life that's closing and he needs to, you know, reclaim his youth a little bit.
Right.
What's fascinating to me is simultaneously you're booking the first series regular you've booked for 20 years. So in some ways, those almost feel like opposite journeys.
Uh-huh.
Do you feel that way when you go on set or do you feel like you're relating to Ernie in that way?
How do you mean opposite journeys?
Well, just because to me, this is a huge career breakthrough for you, a milestone, whereas I feel like Ernie's on the precipice of losing the Lodge.
Right.
And...
Well, it's a career breakthrough if the show continues.
Yeah, that's true.
But no. It's very in sync with me because, you know, to just be honest, personally, when I read him, you know, I got it, you know, and like you say, this is a career breakthrough. So let's just look at it from a guy who's been an actor for, you know, almost 40 years or whatever, and never having been slow and steady, but you always want a breakthrough. So I can relate to the idea that I haven't gotten my worth yet. I haven't fulfilled totally my dream yet. I haven't found that part that really kind of, you know, fits me like a glove. I mean, there have been those, but you always feel that way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I could understand his need to feel like he's leaving some tracks. You know, when he's gone, you know that he's been here, you know. That's a very human thing, you know. That's something that any of us can relate to, someone who wants their life to have meaning. You know, what Jim did with all of the regular characters, he gave us bios, which you do in theater a lot.
Right.
You know, you create a history. And he gave us the histories of our characters. And with Ernie, his mother and father were deceased. He was in a relationship and had a child, and the child was lost in childbirth or wherever. And that relationship ended. Basically, he was a guy living alone, a plumbing salesman with no family in Long Beach. And the only family that he had was the Lodge, which he sort of adopted, you know, as a place to belong. And that's where his sort of hopes and dreams started to materialize and present themselves. So I can understand that. And in my own personal life at the time, I had a sudden loss in my family, you know, and I had to figure things out in terms of how to handle certain situations. So I understood that whole idea that underlines that it's running through the show of grief and loss. And Ernie had his own grief, his own loss. It's different than Dud's, not as present as Dud's, you know, but it's there.
Mm-hmm.
So there were emotions and feelings that I was going through that I had, that I knew would fit this character, you know?
Yeah.
And if I was just willing to share them, you know, through this character. So I looked at it as, you know, an opportunity to, you know, sometimes you run into a part where what you're going through and what the character's going through, it just fits, you know, and you can make use of it, so.
Yeah. You've mentioned Dud, and for those who haven't seen Lodge, Dud is sort of your odd couple buddy in the show, played by Wyatt Russell, who I really like in the show too. I'm excited for him. I think he might be on the verge of being like a Marvel superhero. Or something. Don't you feel that way a little bit?
Yeah, exactly.
But
we're seeing the birth of the career. Wyatt Russell,
Chris Pratt and Parks and Rec. I think we might be seeing that with Wyatt. Right. But
it'd be Wyatt. Yeah.
No, I'm sure he seems like the guy that would always say hi. But I want to know, what's it like working with him? And it's funny, on paper, if I'm a producer, I look at this partnership of you and Wyatt and I think,
what an odd couple.
But on it's so magical on screen, and I just want to hear you speak to that a little bit.
Well, you know, it's hard for me to speak about like what you see. You know, I mean, all I can do is do what I do.
It's fair.
Or do the part, you know. All I know is that working with Wyatt is very easy. We didn't do any of those pre-reads, chemistry reads to see if we fit, you know. I didn't know him from Adam. He didn't know me from Adam when we got together to do the first table read. But we just clicked, you know. It was just, we just clicked, you know. He's the lead of the show and the number one guy on the show. And it's very important how that number one guy, you know, carries himself and how he relates to the other actors and the crew. And he's just very good with everybody. He sets a really nice tone. You know, he goes the extra mile. If we have to be there late and work late, he does it. If you need to do a scene and, you know, you need him there to do the off-camera dialogue, he does it.
That's nice.
He doesn't shy away from making the show better and all the small ways that go into making it better. So it's just easy. You know, and I think from growing up in the business, we used to talk about that sometimes. And I think they just did a great job with teaching him that it's a profession, it's a craft.
Right.
And you take it seriously. And he does.
I love hearing that. Well, we don't have too much more time, but I would just love to ask you, as someone who's worked for as long as you have in this business, how have you seen it change and evolve? And I think specifically, I'm interested in your lens as an actor of color, what that journey's been like for you, if you feel like there are more opportunities for you now, or just I'd love to hear you speak on that specifically.
Wow, that's such a tough question.
I know. You have 3 minutes.
Well, things are getting better. I mean, I could not sit here and say that. You know, when I started out in the late 70s, that, you know, we had the blaxploitation movies and they came and went, you know. And but now you see a lot of things happening in series television, a lot more things happening in film, you know. So it is, there's more opportunity for actors of color now than there were when I started. Having said that, I'd like to see less or more projects like Lodge, where there's diversity within the project. You know, and it's not like this is an African American movie, this is an Asian movie, this is a Latino movie, this is, you know, and, you know, we have all of these, there's a lot more of all of that, but I'd like to see more of just people being interacting with each other as we do in life,
right?
You know,
that's what I love about Lodge, is it's such a diverse cast, but it feels like such a non-obligatory diversity.
Exactly.
Whereas on some shows, it's like, you know, that the casting call demanded an African American actor here. Whereas I think I can't picture anyone else playing Ernie, but I do feel like your race is incidental to the character.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what was so pleasing about it for me, you know, was the idea that anybody could play him, you know. But, you know, for Jim's own reasons, this is what he wanted.
Right.
He wanted this odd couple, this, you know, and he got it.
Yeah.
But that's great, you know, and I hope that kind of thing happens more and more, because I think, you know, ultimately, you know, it'll just create better stuff for everybody. Yeah.
And hopefully a shift in the culture, too. I mean, if we talk about the effect and the power of pop culture on politics and, you know, the way we interact.
Right, right.
I think seeing projects that champion diversity just for the sake of human inclusion
can
do so much.
Exactly.
Well, I have a couple like speed round questions for you to make
your
way out.
All right.
Any dream directors?
I have to answer them
if you would like to pass. Or, yeah,
okay.
If you 10 seconds, I think would be ideal.
All right.
A director that you would love to work with that you haven't worked with.
Ryan Coogler.
Oh, that's a great answer.
Mm-hmm.
Where did my list go? I just lost it. Maybe an actor that you haven't worked with that you'd love to work with.
Oh, wow. I can't pass on that. I have to pass on that.
That's fair.
There's too many good actors out there, and you know.
That's totally fair.
Yeah.
Like a maybe a bucket list of a character, like a superhero or like a private eye in action, something that you haven't played that you'd love to play.
Man, you know, I mean, I have the greatest character, you know, I feel I've had, you know. I like characters,
yeah.
You know. I don't like myths, myth making, you
yeah.
know. I like real people, complex people, you know. So anything that's like fully human,
yeah.
you know, with all the complexities of being a human being, you know, I'm more into the artistic side than the commercial, you know, been there, done that type of stuff, you know.
Absolutely. That's why Lodge is such a great show for you to be working on.
Thank you.
Finally, any aspirations to write or direct? You've been acting for so long.
Well, I direct in theater.
Cool.
I think I'm past the point of giving TV and film a shot. And I do write.
Mm-hmm.
I did a solo show once that I wrote,
cool.
and I'm playing around with some other ideas now. But that's about it. Yeah.
Well,
I just want to keep acting.
Yeah.
Keep getting good parts. You know, and in different kinds of things. You know, I hope this kind of thing continues. Where you know, it's about things that mean something. You
right.
know?
Well, the good news is if Lodge goes for season two, which I really hope it does because I'm loving it. And for those listening, I urge you to watch this show. I know you might not have heard a ton about it, but it's a very, very special show. It's unlike anything else that's airing in the best way. It almost feels like a great Netflix binge to me because of it's again, it's written by a novelist. And I just think it has this sneak attack kind of surprise power
right,
on
right,
you where all
right.
of a sudden the show sweeps
yeah,
you up.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I really urge you to check it out. And Brent, you're so good in it.
Well,
I just want to let you know it's as someone who's worked as long as you have, it's so cool to
yeah.
see that one of your most moving performances is happening right,
right
now.
Right. And it's a great cast. I mean, everybody yeah. does a great job in it. It's
Everyone's
really,
wonderful.
You know, no one's, you know, dropping the ball.
Right. But when season two goes, maybe they'll let you direct an episode in that season. We can
I think it'll
it
have
up.
To be like four, maybe.
Yeah,
season
that's
four.
It's
yeah.
season nine. We can let the
yeah,
actors
yeah,
direct,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, Brent, it's been such an honor to interview you. I really, really appreciate
it's
it.
It's been a very pleasant experience.
Good,
I appreciate
I'm glad.
It.
You're welcome back anytime, too,
okay.
just so you know.
Okay.
So, guys, this has been Spotlight On here on AfterBuzz TV. My name is Jeff Graham. Again, today I talked to Brent Jennings, who, among many projects, is starring in Lodge 49, which is on AMC. That airs on Monday nights, and you can go check out the whole show online. If you love it as much as I do, tweet to AMC, let them know you're loving it, tweet to Jim Gavin. And
tweet,
just
tweet,
some
tweet, tweet, tweet.
Tweet, tweet, yeah, and just let them know. It's a very special show, and it's the kind of thing, when it survives, you have a faith in what television can do.
Exactly.
For actors and viewers as well. So, my name is Jeff. If you guys want to check me out online, you can do that at Jeffrey C. Graham. On Fridays, I host a show called The Unproduced Table Read, where we read unmade, award-winning pilots and features with a group of professional actors
wow.
and interview the writers. If you ever want to come
yeah,
on the show,
me.
I'd love to have you on the
yeah,
show, Brent.
Yeah.
That would be amazing. We're actually on a brief hiatus, but that's normally Fridays on Popcorn Talk, and you can check that out on iTunes as well. Wyatt, not Wyatt, Brent,
yes.
besides Lodge 49, anything else you're promoting right now?
No, not really. I'm just doing a recurring on a television show called All American, which
oh, yeah.
starts in October.
That's CW. It's getting great
yeah,
reviews right now.
Yeah,
great.
So I have a couple of episodes on that.
We'll be covering that, so we'll bring you in when that airs.
Okay,
definitely.
Well,
yeah.
if you think it's worth bringing me in.
We'll see. Yeah, I shouldn't say that now.
Right, wait till you see it.
Yeah, fair enough. Guys, this has been AfterBuzz TV. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
Our founder, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and me, Maria Menounos, would like to thank you for tuning in to AfterBuzz TV. Remember, we're not just the first, we're the biggest in the world, and we're the only destination for all your favorite TV shows. Whatever you crave, we've got it. So go to AfterBuzzTV.com and check out our lineup. Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.